And we're back here on Unusual Sources 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and to the rest of the world at our online streaming service, cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Very pleased to say, as earlier we had mentioned, we are going to be on with Anne Garrison. Now, she's quite a prolific personality. You'll find her on Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. You'll find her at Global Research, Counterpunch, Black Agenda Report. Those are some of the online publications that she writes for. She has a recent one on Counterpunch. We'll be talking with her about that. But I think we have her on the line. Anne, are you with us?
I'm right here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, this is great. We love it. You've got a lot of attention and followers on your Facebook account, and now you've got some recent stuff about Trump versus Hillary and the Greens on Counterpunch. Today, we want to talk about the Green Party campaign, and there's a lot we want to investigate there. But before we go into the details of the party and the campaign and Jill Stein and everything, there's a pertinent issue that presents itself immediately to me, and that has to do with the fallout from the Democratic convention. You know, with what happened to Bernie Sanders' campaign and what they did. I'm wondering, people must be looking at third parties quite seriously now. I'm wondering, are Bernie Sanders supporters coming over to the Greens? Is there evidence of that? Or how's it looking as a result, especially of the Clinton candidacy?
Well, there's no doubt about that. There were quite a few Bernie Sanders supporters who said all along that they were going to switch their support to Jill Stein if Bernie endorsed Hillary. And as you know, Jill Stein asked Bernie to join the Greens, offered him the top of the ticket. He said no. He never even responded. I think Chris Hedges said something very important about this. He said Bernie Sanders turned his back on his most important historical moment. If at the DNC, he had stood up and said, this process wasn't fair, I'm leaving, I'm walking out to join the Green Party or to make an independent run, his delegates would have walked out with him.
Yeah.
Now many of them are confused, don't know what to do. But they're definitely Bernie supporters defecting to the Greens. The information on it so far is kind of anecdotal. Pew Research came up with a poll in which they said that 10% of Sanders supporters would support Jill Stein. But who knows how they asked the question and who they were asking. I'm here in Houston for the convention, and there's some people from Austin, Texas here, and they say that everybody in Austin who was supporting Bernie is now supporting Jill Stein, and someone actually rented them prime office space for very little money because he supports the Stein campaign.
Wow. Okay. Well, that certainly is supported by some of the chatter that we're seeing on the internet, on social media, and elsewhere. As other commentators have pointed out, you know, the Sanders campaign, whether or not it was being used to you know, rope in left supporters and young people, it seems to have created a movement. And in some respects, is beyond the control now of the Democratic Party and the DNC, and we saw evidence of that at the convention itself. I mean, a number of prominent individuals seem to have given support over to the Greens. We can talk about the VP pick, but I understand Cornel West is actually someone who is endorsing the Greens. Is that right?
As soon as the platform committee meetings were over, where Cornel West put up mighty objections to what went into the platform, most notably what went in about Israel and Palestine. And he crossed over to the Greens as soon as the platform committee meetings were over. He said, if we're going to go down, I'm going to go down with Sister Jill.
Right.
And he pointed to how dire our circumstances as people living on the planet are.
Yeah. This is someone whose opinions on a lot of matters related to U.S. politics are taken very seriously. There's also the VP pick that we heard about recently. But I guess, you know, and we get into that issue for our Canadian listeners. They might not be too familiar with the U.S. Green Party. I mean, it's had some notable candidates. But in terms of its positions, its platform points, and Jill Stein, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what the party's about or what kind of alternative it's trying to offer to the two-party system right now?
Well, the Green Party around the world shares something called the four pillars. Let me see if I can rattle them off. They're diversity, decentralization, ecological wisdom, and now I'm going to forget the first. I think economic justice. And some parties have a variant on the four pillars, elaborating on them, called the Ten Keys. Jill Stein is advocating decentralization, local food systems, local sustainable food and energy systems, greater community. You know, we're all isolated and dependent on these huge, unsustainable energy and food systems. Which are highly centralized, so that the people who own and control them can vastly concentrate wealth in their own hands.
Yeah, you mentioned that there's an international component to that. That's interesting. Of course, there's green parties in a number of countries, Canada and elsewhere. You've done research internationally on other green parties, I think, including in Rwanda and some of the difficulties they face there. I mean, it can be very difficult if you're not a mainstream party. There's certain issues when you're dealing with a duopoly in the United States. One of the problems that all third parties face is being called a spoiler. You know, we had to deal with that in the case of Ralph Nader, who we all remember, if anyone was alive at that time, was blamed. He was blamed for the loss of the election to George W. Bush by Al Gore.
And they still bring up the N-word all the time. The people who make the spoiler argument, they bring up the N-word.
Nader.
And I don't think we're taking that very seriously this time. I'm encouraging people to say, well, Ralph did not cost Al Gore the election, but so what if he did? It's an election.
Well, people act as if the Bush campaign and the victory of the Republicans was the end of the world. It was a very destructive presidency, but I think what people are missing is how do you lose to George W. Bush? You know, how do you get into a point where you're locked into a 49%, 51%, 50-50 split with George W. Bush? Now, the problem that the Democrats had was they actually won that election, and the Electoral College screwed it up, and then they didn't contest it. So they were given the option to say, we don't want Bush in, we think it's really bad for America, and he stole the election, we won, but they didn't actually do that, did they?
Well, wait, they didn't do what?
Well, they didn't fight for their own election.
They didn't fight, no. I mean, Al Gore took the case to the Supreme Court, but he didn't fight further in other ways that he could have. And when it was stolen then in 2004 in Ohio, John Kerry more or less said, okay, can I go home now? And I think it's very important to understand in this election now that in poll after poll, Bernie Sanders beat Donald Trump by a greater margin than Hillary Clinton. And the disapproval ratings of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were really high. So the elite Democrats and the Democratic National Committee were more concerned about stopping Bernie Sanders' campaign for equality and climate justice and the other things that he represented, controlling the banksters, than they were about stopping Trump. If they had really been concerned about stopping Trump, they would not have sabotaged the Bernie Sanders campaign the way they did.
Well, that's very interesting you bring that up. I think that's a very valuable observation, because now all of the Democrats are bullying people all over the place, on the internet, wherever you are. They're saying you have to vote for Hillary. You have to vote for Hillary or Trump gets in, and it would be so bad for America if Trump got in. Well, actually, Bernie, as you said, Sanders was polling better than Clinton against Trump. If you wanted an anti-Trump candidate, you would have put in Bernie Sanders and thereby defeated Donald Trump. But instead of doing that, they deliberately chose to destroy the Bernie Sanders campaign. And those emails have come out now, which have shown that they did conspire to do what they could to keep the Sanders campaign down, suppressed, broken, so that Hillary could win. So their primary threat, their primary objective seemed to be to destroy the Sanders campaign, not Donald Trump. And now they're going around telling everyone you have to vote for Clinton, an unpopular candidate, or Trump's going to get in.
Yeah, we had an experience in the San Francisco Bay Area that has some parallels. In 2003, a Green Party candidate, Matt Gonzalez, who later ran with Ralph Nader as his vice presidential candidate, was running for mayor. And I've never seen people excited and mobilized about that race in any other situation. Except maybe the Bernie Sanders campaign. People were really excited about the Bernie Sanders campaign. But the idea that a member of the Green Party might be elected mayor in a major city like San Francisco so upset the Democrats that they sent all the heavy hitters. They hit both the... I'm
hearing music. Well, that's odd. We seem to be having a phone issue with Ann. Let's take a moment, call back, see what happened there.
And okay, just catch me after the music.
And we're back. Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU. I think we may be back with Ann Garrison in the United States. Ann, do we have you on the line again?
Yes, you do, and I'm sorry about the crackle on the speakerphone.
Oh, well, I'm glad we got you on your mobile now, and so yes. That's fine. We're sorry about that interruption. You know, we were just talking about the issue of spoilers, Ralph Nader, and then the Democrats getting rid of their strongest anti-Trump candidate and then blaming other people if they don't succeed against Trump. But you point out there's a whole long history to this. I think you were talking about San Francisco.
In San Francisco in 2003, Matt Gonzalez was a Green. He was on the Board of Supervisors. He was running for mayor. There was a huge amount of energy behind that campaign, a huge amount of progressive activist energy. And the Democratic Party was so horrified by the thought that a Green might become the mayor of a major American city like San Francisco that they sent all their heavy hitters. They sent the Clintons. They sent the Clintons again. They sent Jesse Jackson. It seemed like they tried harder to defeat Matt Gonzalez in that mayoral campaign than they tried to elect John Kerry the next year.
Yeah, no, it seems that any threat to the duopoly is taken very seriously. But we're still being coached by all sorts of figures that we all got to line up and vote for Hillary Clinton now. And I think on Counterpunch even, we've been seeing a debate. Noam Chomsky and some academic colleagues have been saying basically you have to vote for Clinton, or we're recommending that people vote for Clinton, and especially in swing states or whatever, contested states. And the reasoning or the arguments they're giving to left-wing people is they're saying, if you vote for a third-party candidate, like the Greens or someone, and then Trump wins that state, then you are responsible for the things that Trump does as president. But they don't make the same argument. They don't say, if you vote for Clinton in order to prevent Trump, they don't say that you will be responsible for acts that Clinton does, wars and bombings.
There's a case to be made that Trump is a better candidate. Sure, he's racist, he's sexist, he's homophobic, he has horrible taste, he owns gold toilet seats, and he's like, he's everything that makes liberals squirm. And he's the worst on all the identity politics issues. But he has also gone on record against the TPP, said he wanted to renegotiate NAFTA, said that pharmaceutical companies should have to negotiate with Medicare over the price of their bills instead of charging whatever they please. And he's gone on record in opposition to so-called humanitarian wars. He hasn't gone so far as to say they're not really humanitarian, to debunk the R2P mythology, but he has said they're too expensive.
Well, we're being pitched Hillary as a lesser evil candidate. I mean, we're now in the sad state of people having a choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And so people are trying to say, well, in this case, we have to vote for the lesser evil. But I think the problem with this reasoning is this has been going on for a while. The Democrats run against all sorts of outrageous people and say that you have to vote for them as the lesser evil. Where has that delivered us? That's delivered us to Clinton versus Trump as the primary candidates.
Exactly.
So, I mean, lesser. If you're going to vote for evil, or what you call a lesser evil, you're going to still end up with evil.
And the Democrats will never give us anything so long as they can count on us voting on fear of the Republican. But the Republican is not more frightening. They're both horrible. I mean, it's taken billions of dollars to nominate two of the worst people on the planet.
Well, I guess in that case, what you need to do is you need to vote for something that actually represents you. What does the saying go? I'd rather vote for what I want and not get it than vote for what I don't want and then get it. That's a famous labor slogan. And, you know, so people have to vote for what they want. And, you know, their third parties are suddenly becoming a lot more interesting to a lot of voters in the United States. You have I noticed the Green Party has its VP pick now. Isn't that a gentleman from Counterpunch, actually?
Counterpunch and the Black Agenda Report. He's an editor and contributor to the Black Agenda Report. He is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and he's the founder of human rights organization. I think it's called the International Human Rights Network, but it's different from the big NGOs like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, one of which, Amnesty International, he had some past association with. But I'm just learning about this organization, but it's more about empowering people to demand and secure their own rights.
Mm-hmm. So for a very grassroots orientation, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a grassroots human, empowering human rights organization.
Well, I've read his.
We have some of this coverage of Africa in common, and Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International both make my hair stand on end in that part of the world. I'm sure you've heard that the critique of those organizations, that they're very involved with the State Department.
No, yes, you've done very good work on the subject, and certainly we need a greater diversity of human rights, or what they call human rights organizations, NGOs, grassroots groups, and so on. And looks like your VP pick may represent some of that. People can go to Counterpunch and look up his articles just as they can yours. But you've pointed out this is a very depressing election. A lot of Americans feel that way. In the case of alternatives and voting for the Greens, I'm wondering about your thoughts on the viability of the campaign. I mean, can Jill Stein win? Is the campaign viable?
Well, she probably can't win, especially because she cannot get into the debates. If Jill were allowed into the presidential debates, and if Ajamu Baraka were allowed to debate Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, the response that got the candidate who got such a response from the Bernie delegates, then it would be a whole different story. And there was a lawsuit filed in 2012 against the Corporate Commission on Presidential Debates, which controls who gets into the debates. I don't know at what point that lawsuit is right now. Litigation takes years and years, so it might well still be on. But the rule now is, I believe, that Jill would have to get 15% in three nationally recognized polls to be allowed to get into the debates. And it's very hard for her to get to 15% if nobody can see her. Most people get their news and their information about the presidential race from TV. And if they're not going to see Jill on TV, then they're not going to know she's an option.
Well, this is very troubling. You've pointed out a structural problem here, and that is people are on the lookout for alternatives. there's a most, I mean, it was what, 7 or 9% of Americans that basically picked Trump and Clinton. That was the percentage that was involved in those decisions. So for the other 90% of Americans, they're looking for options. There's Bernie supporters that are looking for options. You know, his capitulation to Hillary there was seen as more, he did more than necessary to stand down there, and it upset a lot of his supporters at the convention. So there's people that are looking for alternatives, and yet it's very difficult for anyone who's not part of a two-party duopoly to get on the ballot, to get on TV, and so on. Is there enough measures being taken to raise awareness of this issue across the United States? You know, are people learning now, perhaps, or perhaps the hard way, that if you want to get someone beyond the Democrats and the Republicans, that you're going to have to enact some kind of structural change just to have a voice and be heard in an election campaign?
No, I wouldn't say people are getting that. And if you're talking about American politics, one of the first realities you have to consider is disengagement. That the American electorate is most fundamentally disengaged. I'd say isolated by all the large systems that we're all dependent on, that keep us from seeking community or solutions with our own neighbors, because we're all dependent on these vast energy and food energy, food, and media systems that most people don't know their own neighbors, and usually the majority of Americans don't even vote. It's rare to have an election where more than 50% of the population votes. When Barack Obama was elected, that was a high, that was the highest percentage of voter participation in decades. I can't offhand remember how many decades, but it was extraordinarily high, and that election could not be stolen. Neither of the elections could be stolen from Barack Obama, because he won by such a wide margin. Only a close election can be stolen.
So one of the problems that you're lacking in the United States is a sense of community, to have people discussing and being involved in things. It's something that you actually need in order to move on to the next step, which is to be fielding third-party candidates and things like that. It sounds like you have a tough situation to deal with there, unfortunately, but I suppose we all knew that going in. Making more...
Well, it's not just tough for us, it's tough for the rest of the world. I mean, I try to imagine people in other parts of the world who are so vulnerable to what we're going to do next, watching these warmongering clowns stepping up to become the next commander-in-chief.
Well, I wish that you were wrong, but actually, unfortunately, that's true. The choice of the next president will dramatically affect people all over the world. And I don't think they're looking too happily at either of the two presidential choices. Trump has had a lot of heated rhetoric, and Clinton, we have a record. People talk about her foreign policy experience as a reason to vote for her. But when we think about foreign policy experience in Clinton's case, we know that her major actions as a politician in the last 8 years have been to enact military aggression in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere. This is the department that's supported a coup in Honduras is one of the first things that happened when Obama got in. And there's going to be more war, more responsibility to protect, more Samantha Power type intervention. So, unfortunately, you're right. Despite American disengagement, their president is going to have a dramatic impact on the rest of the world, and we don't get to vote. We don't get to vote in Canada. They don't get to vote in Libya. They don't get to vote in Nigeria. They don't get to vote anywhere. So if we don't see more positive engagement by citizens, of course, not only the United States, but the rest of the world is looking at calamity.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fundamental flaw in democracy as we understand it, which is that a country with an overwhelming military domination of the world like that of the U.S. can vote and to elect someone who makes war on much of the rest of the world who didn't get to vote. the fundamental problem and a reason, an argument for international law, that although, you know, that's sort of an ideal, it's way out of reach if you've considered any of the international courts and the way that the UN works.
Yes, it's all very, yeah.
There's something else I want to say about Jill and Bernie Sanders, in contrast. Bernie Sanders advocated climate justice and the idea of a Green New Deal, something like Jill's. But Bernie's advocacy for that was not realistic because he didn't have a foreign policy that went with it. The Pentagon is the world's largest consumer of fossil fuels. It's the largest consumer of coal-to-liquid transport fuels made by the Cecil Corporation in Africa, in South Africa. And, in fact, the fossil fuel emissions of the Pentagon, the number, the measure of them, is a national security issue. It's a secret, because if the world knew the size of the Pentagon's fossil fuel emissions, it would be a national security issue.
Yes.
So when you hear how high the U.S. is in its fossil fuel consumption, that's not even counting the Pentagon.
The Pentagon may well be the largest polluter in the world. Certainly, the emissions from all those jets, ships, aircraft carriers, rockets, the amount of fuel that tank battalion consumes, people have put those figures on the internet. It's all very staggering, and behind all the talk of green this and sustainable that, the United States military is an enormous consumer of energy and creator of emissions and pollution and so on. It's hard to put a realistic facade over that. It is a very serious problem. It means that green plans that don't address the U.S. military footprint all over the world with its 800 bases, you know, are very compromised. Well, it's all very, you've painted a very hellish portrait of the difficulties you're all facing in the United States. We'll have to give more attention to third parties and see what people are doing about this to get some kind of representation in the United States. These are two very unpopular main candidates. Their unfavorables are the highest anyone can remember, and these are the people that we have to choose between unless the third party.
But I'm excited. I'm excited because third parties are getting attention. Jill is getting attention. I flew out here. I was sitting next to a gentleman from St. Croix, and he knew who Jill Stein was, and he asked me how many Bernie's voters would migrate to Jill Stein. People all around the world know who Jill Stein is now. And, you know, she's part of the conversation far more than she has been, or the Green Party has been, in the past. I mean, in some ways, it may have to get worse before it can get better.
Well,
but I'm excited because we're at least part of the conversation now.
Well, it looks like there have been steps then. You know, we're in a period of transition. The issues about globalization and war and other unemployment, job loss, free trade are tearing up the major parties, both the Republicans and the Democrats, and it is a time mm-hmm. in which new parties and other forms of change can emerge. So, of course, we're going to be keeping a close eye on that. It's at stake for everyone, not just the United States, but as you pointed out, the rest of the world. So we'll be keeping an eye on that, and people can, of course, tune into Counterpunch to find your articles on that subject. So, Anne, thanks very much.
Oh, and I would recommend reading Ajamu Baraka. I just started doing this myself. I had read some of his work, but now that he's our VP pick, I am reading all of his articles on Black Agenda and Counterpunch, and he's an extraordinary writer, very, very insightful and gifted with language, and he has a lot of insight and activist experience about both African America and the African continent. That's really exciting.
Of course, well, we can find both of you at Counterpunch, www.counterpunch.org. So I'm looking forward to that. So, Anne, thanks very much for being with us today.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Sure. Thanks. Bye-bye. That was Anne Garrison, who writes for a number of online publications, Counterpunch, Black Agenda Report, other places. And also, she's radio journalist herself, covering Rwanda specifically. We caught her in the middle of a convention that's going on with the Green Party, in the middle of a hive of activity. We'll see the results of that in the upcoming days and weeks as we get reporting on Green Party coverage and what third parties are doing in this stage of the election.